I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guests Anne-Marie Slaughter and Daniel Dresner have been engaged in a lively debate over the last few months about foreign policy. At the root of their argument is whether digital and network media are changing international politics. For instance, have Facebook, Twitter, and other social media given those out of power more influence and more tools to challenge entrenched governments? Or, in spite of all the attention that social media has gotten, have they really upended the status quo and the concentration of powers? These are heady and important questions, and we've invited Dresner and Slaughter to have their debate on Radio Times today. Emery Slaughter is the Bert G. Kerstetter University Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University. She's a columnist for The Atlantic, and for the first 2 years of the Obama administration, she was Director of Policy Planning for the United States Department of State, and she joins us from Princeton University's Broadcast Center. Anne-Marie Slaughter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's always a pleasure.
And Daniel Dresner, joining us by telephone, is Professor of International Politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a senior editor at the National Interest and a contributing editor at Foreign Policy, where he has a daily blog. And Dan Dresner, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Always a pleasure, Marty.
And Dan, is this a friendly argument you've been having with Anne-Marie Slaughter?
Oh, I would like to think it's definitely a friendly argument. It's a productive argument because by having these disagreements, we can also invite others to participate in the debate as well. And I don't think it's one where we necessarily have fixed positions, but one where we can sort of try to clarify where we disagree about the way the world works.
Do you agree with that, Anne-Marie?
I do agree with that. In first place, we're friends and colleagues, and we've written about what each other's done in our articles. This is a debate that invites many others, many international relations graduate students, many people just interested in foreign policy to agree, disagree, qualify, characterize, or add what they think.
But would you say, Anne-Marie, that it is a search for a new foreign policy in this very complicated and interconnected world that we live in?
I think so. The view that I am putting forward is a view that says, of course, states are major actors in the international system. They will remain major actors. But for the 21st century, social actors, those can be activists, non-governmental organizations, foundations, businesses, universities, the full range, those social actors are also very important agents of change in the international system, and we need a worldview that takes account of both of them.
What's your disagreement with that, Daniel Dresner?
I would say I probably have a few disagreements with that. The first is the notion that this is new in the 21st century. Things like social networks have been around for quite some time. Take a look at the Rothschild banking network, for example, in the 19th century, or even the Medici during the time of the Renaissance. So the Maghrebi traders even before that. So networks have been around for a while. I think the difference in the 21st century is that they're far more visible because so many of them are on the internet. And so as a result, we're sort of seeing things for the first time that I think had been around for a while before that, but because we all can see them on the internet, they seem a little more new and interesting. I think the second source of disagreement that Anne-Marie and I have is the extent to which these kinds of social groups and social networks genuinely transform world politics. I certainly don't deny their existence, and they're interesting to study. I don't know, however, if they really fundamentally alter the ways in which world politics works. They might alter the ways in which foreign policy officials have to handle things, because there's sort of more real-time responses that are necessary now that weren't, let's say, you know, even 30 years ago. But I'm not sure it fundamentally changes the way world politics works.
Emery, were you and are you talking about the Arab Spring that essentially sprung up earlier this year?
That's the most visible current manifestation, but I would say since 9/11, whether it's been negative networks or positive networks, the global security and global change have been driven either by networks of terrorists or other criminals, drug traffickers, arms traffickers, or now by positive social movements. And I agree with Dan that there have always been these movements around. The difference is not just visibility today. It's that anyone with a computer can create a network and mobilize it.
What do you say to that, Daniel Dresner?
I think it's true. The startup costs to creating a network are much lower now because the sort of information, all you need is a decent internet connection. On the other hand, it's not necessarily obvious to me that these groups actually change world politics all that much for a couple of reasons. First of all, we tend to have a selection effect where we tend to notice the networks that succeed and less on the networks that actually don't necessarily have that much influence. So as a result, we see the ones that seem to have very prominent success, both sort of dark networks like Al-Qaeda or more successful networks like, let's say, Jubilee 2000. The second thing is that
But wait a minute, Dan. If we can, you're agreeing that those networks have changed world politics?
I think those networks have definitely had some influence over world politics. Although I think if you sort of step back a little bit, the interesting question is whether or not their influence can be sustained, and that's where I'm actually a little more pessimistic. I'm not sure that Al-Qaeda did in the end have a fundamental effect on U.S. foreign policy, but it's funny, looking at the sort of 10-year anniversary of 9/11, it's not clear to me that Al-Qaeda is going to have that sustained an effect, actually.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think one of the key points here to be made is I'm not ruling out governments. I'm often talking about the relationship between networks and governments. So I would argue that Al-Qaeda attacks the United States on 9/11. The United States, in response, invades Afghanistan and then Iraq. We could debate about whether that was right. That change truly had a huge impact on U.S. power, interstate relations, and world politics.
It did. The question is whether or not the network was responsible for that. There's no question. I mean, I think we're in agreement that, an invasion of Afghanistan does not take place without the 9/11 attacks. But let's extend to this the question of the invasion of Iraq, something which, both you and I supported at the time, but in retrospect, obviously, looks like a colossal disaster. And I'm not sure that had anything to do with Al-Qaeda so much as it had to do with the sort of foreign policy calculations of the Bush administration. That's an instance where, there was state choice, and you can argue the choice was the wrong one. But I don't think that it was necessarily in reaction to Al-Qaeda.
Go ahead, Anne-Marie.
No. So I was just going to say the Bush administration deliberately fudged the connection to Al-Qaeda, and a majority of Americans, I think, still believed that Al-Qaeda was connected to Iraq. So here again, we go back to the importance of social actors. Mm-hmm. Without that belief on the part of the American people, I'm not sure he could have invaded Iraq.
Let me shift gears and actually go back to the Arab Spring, and I want to go back to you, Anne-Marie Slaughter, and even talk about Egypt, where Tahrir Square, we saw all these activists out challenging their government. Mubarak is no longer in power. But they do seem to be kind of stuck at this point in terms of creating a new kind of government. Does that show the limit of some of these social networks?
Well, I think it shows the limit of any revolution, whether it's empowered by technology or not. It's always harder to build a new government than to overthrow an old one. But I think this is a very important question. Ultimately, what overthrew the Egyptian government, the Tunisian government, was the will and the determination of people who are willing to take to the streets and fight for their beliefs. The question we have is whether or not digital technology made it easier or even possible for them to do that. And the participants in those movements themselves say the access to digital technology meant they could stay one step ahead of state security forces and thus could mobilize enough people that ultimately they couldn't be put down.
You could disagree with that, Daniel Dresner?
I would dispute it somewhat. I think the evidence is still extremely unclear about the role that social networking technology had in Egypt and Tunisia. I think there's some evidence that suggests it played a role. I'm not sure the role was all that great. I think the more intriguing thing is to point out that as the Arab Spring has developed, and indeed we sort of saw this already with Iran during the Green Movement in 2009, is that states can also quickly adapt and exploit those very networks to their own purposes, which is to say they can either choose to censor them if they want to as a way of blocking that kind of social movements or collective action, but even more significantly, more disturbingly, they can penetrate those networks as a way of gathering intelligence on opposition movements. And so as a result, I'm not sure, in some ways this is almost like a constant race between social movements and states trying to gain the information advantage. And I think Anne-Marie is correct that there are moments where, in fact, social movements can, you know, have the opportunity to can have that edge. But I think that edge doesn't necessarily last. It's ephemeral, unfortunately.
Well, Anne-Marie,
but I think that...
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
That exactly makes my point, that you've got the technology of liberation, which the social movements are using, and the technology of oppression, which the governments are moving. But it's that relationship.
Technology.
Yes, exactly. But it's the relationship between how social movements use it and how governments use it. That's the relationship I'm so interested in focusing on in foreign policy that determines who comes out on top.
Well, Dan, even the news this morning had to do with Syria and the kind of back and forth between the protesters and the government, essentially, you know, hacking each other's websites in order to get their information out. I mean, it seems to me, isn't that the world that we live in today?
I think the question is, does that sort of thing matter? I mean, it's like a couple of weeks ago, there was a Twitter fight between the ISAF press spokesman and the Taliban press spokesman after a series of attacks on Kabul. And in some ways, this makes for interesting theater. It's fascinating to watch. What I'm not sure is whether or not it actually has any genuine effect on the situation on the ground. So on the one hand, the sort of, you know, hacking sites that you're talking about in terms of Syria, yes, that can send a symbolic message of the authoritarian government does not necessarily have control over the situation. On the other hand, I don't know if it necessarily gets people out into the streets. And unfortunately, what you're seeing in Syria is an instance where, in fact, what had been a nonviolent protest movement, you know, because you have a state that is unfortunately willing to engage what can only be described as terror tactics to try to repress its own population, is actually forcing that social movement to, you know, in some ways think in a more realpolitik way, which is to think that comparing itself to Libya, realizing that the only way it's going to get what it wants is potentially to try to do it through force of arms.
Well, Anne-Marie, yeah, go ahead. But I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, a Twitter account versus a police or military force.
Well, first place, Dan, the fact that social movements use arms does not make them realpolitik. That's a kind of crazy way to frame the debate. The debate is about whether or not those people on the ground and their relationship to the government is as important as what one government does to another. And I think you're missing the power of harnessing truth. Well, we just heard in the hacking the Syrian website that what is being shown is a map of all the places where there's unrest and all the people who've been killed. The Syrian government clearly thinks that keeping that information from its population and the world will have an impact on whether it wins or not. And this technology in the hands of social forces is cornering it.
I have to say, I disagree strongly with this. The notion that social networks, you know, only direct things towards the power of truth is, I think, incredibly naive. We're talking about
I didn't say that.
Where, you know, 10 years after 9/11, public opinion polls demonstrate that a majority of Arabs still do not believe that al-Qaeda was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. And this was not due to a lack of Internet access or a lack of social networking technology. One of the problems, I think, sometimes with networks is, you know, for a network to thrive, it generally relies on like-minded members. But that can also lead to effects like cocooning, where you have people, you know, sort of reinforcing their own opinions, their own perceptions, and as a result become incredibly hostile data that contradicts their own world.
Hold on
to
that thought.
Happens to be correct.
We're
going to
be right back after a very short break. Stay with us.
The Wistar Institute is proud to support WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a world leader in biomedical research right here in Philadelphia. Today at Wistar, scientists can explore our entire set of genes to answer the question, what causes cancer? This research guides us to design individual therapies for different types of cancer. The Wistar Institute, today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures, online at wistar.org.
You ask for it, we listened. WHYY-FM is trying something new. YStream, pledge-free streaming radio. Listen without membership breaks on your desktop, laptop, iPhone, or iPad. Visit WHYY.org by October 12th, make a $60 pledge, and enjoy WHYY-FM without membership breaks during our entire October fundraising campaign. For more information on YStream, WHYY's new pledge-free stream, visit WHYY.org.
WHYY is proudly supported by the MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey, presenting 10 Cents a Dance, a new musical, with performances now through October 9th. Director John Doyle of Broadway's Sweeney Todd brings his touch to the Rodgers and Hart songbook with a cast that doubles as the orchestra, featuring Malcolm Getz and Donna McKechnie. Ticket information to MacArthur Theater in Princeton, New Jersey at 609-258-2787 or at MacArthur.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Anne-Marie Slaughter and Daniel Dresner. They've been having a debate over the last 2 months on their respective online columns and on Twitter. And at the root of their debate is whether and how digital and network media are changing the nature of international politics. Anne-Marie Slaughter is a professor at Princeton University. Daniel Dresner, a professor at Tufts University. And both of them joining us, obviously, today on Radio Times to talk about this heady stuff. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I have to say, I'm running to keep up with you, but I'm going to do my best here. Emery, let me go back to you, something that Daniel Dresner said right before the break, which is that when you look at social media, it tends to be like-minded people talking to each other. Do you see that as a problem when it comes to international politics?
Well, it can be, and certainly there's nothing in the technology itself that means it's going to be used for good or bad purposes. It could be used for criminal networks just as it can be used for progressive activism. I think there are certainly plenty of cases in which digital technology makes it easier for people to hang out only with like-minded people. On the other hand, I think it makes it far easier to hear from a much broader group of voices. In my own use of Twitter, for instance, I'm now in touch with many, many, many people who disagree with me and have different perspectives than I would be if I were just talking to my colleagues.
What do you think about that, Dan Dresner?
I think it demonstrates Anne-Marie's enlightened use of Twitter, and I agree with that. I use it the same way to get, you know, a diversity of opinions. Mm-hmm. However, in some ways, what Anne-Marie and I are observers. We're trying to watch what's going on. I'm not necessarily sure social activists would share that same kind of worldview, particularly networks that actually try to achieve social action are going to be far less likely, even if they do allow others to sort of read what they're doing. It's not necessarily clear they're going to listen to people who disagree with them. And this, in some ways, it's both the strength and the weakness of networks. The strength of networks is that, in terms of trying to engage in social activism, is that if they all do have a common worldview, that's why networks can be quicker and more efficient, because there's no need to enforce agreements or anything like that. The problem comes where there's a conflict of values, and networks are actually not that great at all at resolving those kinds of conflicts and values.
Well, Dan, let me ask you something out of the news today, that we heard that the Saudi government is going to give women the right to vote. Now, women have to wait 4 years for that. But nonetheless, it was couched that the government was responding to the uprising in the Arab world and in the neighbors of Saudi Arabia. Obviously, part of that uprising was the use of networks and young people saying that they want rights that other young people have in other parts of the world. Isn't that a good example of how networking can change a government?
I think it's not really. I think it's an example of how a state or a regime will try to do anything it can to survive. And if you take a look at Saudi Arabia's actions writ large, you could argue they've taken far more actions to try to ensure the survival of their system pretty much as is, rather than promote reform. This is of a piece with, you know, the king's intention to try to modernize Saudi society, particularly through the integration of women through the educational system as well. But it should be noted that I believe this particular announcement deals only with sort of local councils. It doesn't deal with the Shura Council, which is the actually important legislative body. And then you also have to contrast this with what Saudi Arabia has done both in the Gulf region and more generally, which is be perfectly willing to try to repress social movements in places like Bahrain or Yemen and invite other monarchies like Jordan and Morocco into the Gulf Cooperation Council as sort of a monarchist bloc, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Go ahead, Anne-Marie.
So, Dan, every time you say that the Saudi government does something negative, you say, well, that's not a response to a network. The networks are only positive. I would say because of the Arab Spring, which are exactly powered by networks of activists and by the ability of those activists to reach across many, many different social groups to oppose the government. The Saudis have cracked down in Bahrain, agreed to pay their people enormous sums, and are now embarking on cautious reform. But all of that still makes the case for the power of networks to force response, whether it's positive or negative response.
Dan?
I think that's a fair point to say that networks can certainly, you know, create responses. I think the question is, you know, in some, there's two things here. The first is, does it create the responses that the networks wanted in the first place? So, for example, if a social network is agitating in Saudi Arabia and the response is it gets repressed, the question is, did it want that or not, and does that actually help achieve its ends or not? The second is that in some ways what we're talking about right now, what we've been talking about for the entire hour, is really the domestic politics of other countries and how these respond to these sorts of movements. And I think this in some ways points to a different kind of cleavage we have, which is when we're talking in the world of domestic politics, I'm probably closer to Anne-Marie on this point, which is to say that, yes, of course domestic social movements can in fact, you know, cause states to respond because in the end all politics is local, despite the fact that I wrote a book saying all politics is global. The interesting question
I think
is
I'll just end my debate now.
What did you say?
She's going to end her
debate. I'll go home.
She feels like she's won, Dan.
The other question, though, is whether or not this affects internet, you know, sort of cross-border international relations, and I think that's a separate issue and one where probably we have a little more disagreement.
Well, then let me raise that, and let me just couch it in these terms, and Emery, I'll toss this back to you, because we do live in a much more interconnected world. I'm thinking about what's going on in Europe today with the euro and how that's going to affect the United States and other countries around the world. You know, the debt crisis seems to be a global crisis at this point. We have pandemics. We have the tsunami in Japan, and of course the reverberations around the world. I mean, do we live in just a much more interconnected world, and then what happens very far away is going to somehow have its impact here in the United States and other countries around the world?
Yes, exactly. We certainly live in a much more interconnected world. The question here is what does that mean? I mean, does it mean just that what happens if a small state does something far away, the big state has to respond? Or does it mean that what's happening on the ground in Western Indonesia or China, if chickens get bird flu and somebody gets on a plane and brings that to us, or environmental change, or again, terrorist networks or religious movements, it's what's happening on the ground that can now cross borders. Either you can connect through networks or simply the impact of different social actors that is really affecting what happens and what we have to respond to.
Dan?
Again, I'm not sure that's necessarily new. We've had cross-border epidemics before. We've even had globalized financial crises before. I think, again, that the difference this time around is that the audience is larger. So when these sorts of things happen, I think common, you know, the ordinary citizens are much more aware of them much more quickly, or at least have the potential to be aware of them much more quickly than in the past. But we've had things like financial contagion, you know, in 1931. We've had it before during crises under the gold standard. Again, I'm not sure this is necessarily new. It's just that it's much easier to observe, unfortunately.
But Dan, are you saying that the governments don't need to either respond to or acknowledge what's happening on social networks?
No, I think governments do need to respond to them, again, particularly if those networks place pressure on their domestic viability. But again, my point is that that wasn't necessarily all that different from what happened previously when, again, essentially the state system was thought to be relatively powerful. So I'm not sure that we're talking about change so much as a constant.
Anne-Marie?
Well, I think the difference in degree is a difference in kind. You can see all of human history as the progress of increasing connectedness from one solitary man to a small community, to a larger community, to a state, to a global system. So, of course, you can find previous examples. But today, the intensity of that interconnection is such that you could get a pandemic in 2 weeks. You could get a financial crisis instantly. You can get terrorist networks that can work all over the world, moving from one country to another. And you can get social movements that aren't just bringing about the Arab Spring. They brought about things like the International Criminal Court or the International Landmines Treaty, again, working with governments. So
Because you're right, it's possibly, again, it's a success. You can show where, in fact, social networks working with friendly governments were able to achieve something that otherwise wouldn't have happened. The interesting question, then, again, is how much it matters, because I would be much more persuaded about the power of the Ottawa Convention if the countries that actually used landmines ratified the convention. Mm. But that actually hasn't happened. And furthermore, it hasn't happened despite the decade of arguments made by these social movements that eventually these governments would feel pressure to conform to the treaty.
Anne-Marie?
Well, I don't want to divulge secrets, but those debates are alive and well in the U.S. government, and exactly because there is steady pressure, and not just from social movements, but our own allies who have all signed these agreements and who are asking, aren't there better ways to protect U.S. interests than through landmines? So these things take time, but this treaty was created remarkably quickly, and we're only about 10 or 15 years since it's been created.
And that's quick in the world of international politics.
That is very
okay.
Well,
just checking. I don't know.
Absolutely. Well, think about it this way: it took decades and decades to abolish slavery, right? Which is one of your first big social movements that achieved its goal. But you're talking 50, 60 years for ultimately everybody to eradicate slavery.
And let me just quickly reintroduce you. We're getting a flavor of a debate that's been going on between our two guests over the last couple of months. Anne-Marie Slaughter from Princeton University has been arguing that network and social media have changed the game of international politics, giving unprecedented powers and access to the otherwise powerless. Dan Dresner from Tufts University has been arguing that despite the media and academic attention that the digital media have received in coverage of events like the Arab Spring, they have not upended the status quo in terms of power and influence, which remain concentrated in great powers. It's a heady debate, but it's an important one as we think about the world that we live in and what is this relationship between these social networks and governments and all of us. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Emory, let me go back to you. And as you and Dan are going back and forth, I'm thinking like a failed state like Somalia. Essentially, it's been governmentless for about a generation. There's lawlessness, institutions in disarray. How do you take this worldview that you have, and obviously this desire to use social networks for the common good? How do you apply that to a place like Somalia? And can it be applied to a place like Somalia?
Well, Marty, it's a great question. And here, actually, Dan and I are likely to agree, which is to say that the international system is as threatened by weak states as it is by strong states, and in this case, no state. Mm-hmm. So we must have states to create a monopoly of violence in a particular territory, as opposed to having warlords shooting wherever they want, to create order, to create the bases for a society. When you don't have a state and you have anarchy, particularly in a globalized world, the dangers that result, whether it's terrorism or famine or disease or regional instability, can affect all of us.
In fact, let me get Olivia from Winmore to join our conversation to weigh in on this very issue. And Olivia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks. Hi, yeah, hi. I heard yesterday on NPR, I believe, at the morning show that the citizens in a Mexican town are using social network to fight the drug cartels, and they really feel like they have an advantage because they can connect and stay anonymous even though they're being threatened. I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that and the prospects of that working.
Well, that's interesting, Olivia. Let me give Dan Dresner a chance to respond to that. Dan, your thoughts?
Well, Olivia has me at a disadvantage because I haven't heard that story. I would suggest that obviously when you're dealing with illicit networks, then it's not shocking that you would see a counter movement of some sort of social organization trying to combat them. So one would certainly hope that that sort of thing would actually address the drug cartel problem, or would at least help to provide some sort of social capital in the affected areas.
Anne-Marie?
Can I
yeah, please, go ahead.
Add there? It's a great question because My column for The Atlantic is called The Foreign Policy Frontier, and this is actually something we worked on intensively at the State Department. Secretary Clinton's advisor for innovation, Alec Ross, went to Mexico working with the U.S. ambassador to Mexico and Carlos Slim, the telecoms giant, in Mexico to make it easier for Mexican citizens to use their cell phones to report this kind of violence. So this is exactly a case where we're trying to use social media positively to address one of the most serious foreign policy problems we have in this hemisphere.
Well, let me just add a dark note here. Dennis Devine just typed in, actually, the story was about the cartels catching on and killing people who had posted information on Facebook. So here we are, you know, in a sense, like things in Syria, which is the use of this social media as a weapon in a way, Dan Dresner,
absolutely,
back and forth.
Well, yes, as I said, you know, one of the problems of this sort of reliance on, particularly on information technologies, is that on the one hand, it allows for very rapid communication, but on the other hand, it allows for states to potentially penetrate those networks. So it's simultaneously a great tool for organizing, but it's also a vulnerability.
Well, and I mean, we're talking about social networks, and obviously they are here to stay, Anne-Marie Slaughter. Governments are here to stay. And again, going back to something I asked earlier, I mean, it's the idea to figure out how to craft some kind of foreign policy, maybe even give it a name that acknowledges some of these movements that are at work?
Well, Secretary Clinton calls it 21st century statecraft, by which she means that the State Department focuses on its relations with other governments, mm-hmm. but it also focuses positively on how we can use technology to connect lots of actors who can help us solve problems. And those can be social groups, those can be businesses who often play an important role, or foundations and universities, a whole raft of social groups. We try to use the federal government as a platform to bring those actors together to counteract to solve problems or counteract the negative uses of these technologies.
Go ahead, Dan.
I would say two things on this. The first is that the question becomes, to what extent does using these kinds of social movements wind up infringing on sovereignty in other countries? And the question is, how will those countries react to this? So on the one hand, it's entirely appropriate to use these kinds of social networks, presumably to advance U.S. interests. The problem becomes whether or not these other countries see this as and see these social networks as simply an adjunct of the U.S. government, whether or not we actually intend that to happen or not. So in some ways, this raises an interesting question about whether or not new emerging powers, how jealous they're going to be guarding their sovereignty. The second thing is that it also depends on the issues you're talking about, where you're going to try to rally these networks. Promoting things like social or economic development are largely speaking, uncontroversial in world politics. I think most people want to see more social mm-hmm. and economic development. The question becomes what happens when you start, you know, tackling issues like, oh, I don't know, Israel-Palestine, for example, that generate far greater controversy and far greater conflict of interest.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And our guests are Anne-Marie Slaughter and Daniel Dresner. Anne-Marie is the Bertschy Kerstetter University Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University. She's also a columnist for The Atlantic, and she was Director of Policy Planning for the United States Department of State for the first 2 years of the Obama administration. And she's been a guest on Radio Times several times. Daniel Dresner, Professor of International Politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a senior editor at The National Interest, a contributing editor at Foreign Policy, where he has a daily blog. He's been a guest on Radio Times as well. And we are talking about this changing new world of social media and its impact on international politics, foreign policy, on how governments deal with each other. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents Audra McDonald in concert on Saturday, October 1st. The four-time Tony Award-winning actress and singer performs at the Kimmel Center before heading back to Broadway to star in the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Known for her dramatic stage presence and classical vocals, Miss McDonald connects with audiences on a deeply personal level. Tickets for Audra McDonald are available at 215-893-1999 or kimmelcenter.org.
Before his memoir, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz spent a year writing about how his mind works. Diagnosed with dyslexia at the age of 58, he set out to describe a lifelong struggle for control over his thoughts and actions. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, Schultz shares his story as we explore the larger topic of learning disabilities with psychologist Richard Selznick, author of The Shutdown Learner, today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Germantown Friends School, nationally recognized for academic excellence and Quaker values for boys and girls grades kindergarten through 12, hosting an open house on Saturday, October 1st at 1 p.m. It's an opportunity to meet faculty, learn about art, drama, music, and athletics programs, and tour the 7-acre historic urban campus, including the new Green Science Center. Germantown Friends School, open house this Saturday, October 1st at 1 p.m. GermantownFriends.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Our guests are Anne-Marie Slaughter and Daniel Dresner. They've been engaged in a lively debate over the last few months about foreign policy. And at the root of their argument is whether digital and network media are changing international politics. Heady stuff. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Well, Daniel Dresner, you mentioned the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, one of the more intractable problems around the world, but Emery, let me go back to you. And does, in being more inclusive about some of this social media, does that open up opportunities, you think, to deal with the Arab-Israeli conflict?
Well, one of the very few positive things I've heard with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is there is a Facebook page where Israelis and Palestinians can meet and engage with each other. And there's a very small island of optimism in a sea of darkness. But let me be clear. There's nothing that I'm arguing that says, look, social networks are going to solve all the world's problems. I'm just arguing that they are an increasingly important factor in forcing governments to do things, but also in causing an impact on world politics themselves. I'm afraid in Israel-Palestine, there's so many different problems that there's no one magic bullet.
But Daniel Dresner, I think we see from that enduring conflict that governments have been hampered in coming up with some kind of resolution.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, it's unfair to judge social networks based on their inability to solve the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, as that's just an intractable problem. But there are a lot of intractable problems in world politics. And I think the interesting question to ask about social networks is whether or not what we're seeing, is it a new form of organization or the new forms of interest? Because as we said before, a lot of what we're talking about are sort of debates within particular countries about the right way to allocate resources. And domestic politics is hardly a new phenomenon. The interesting question is whether or not the use of networks allows interests that heretofore had not been voiced to be voiced before. And I think you can make the case that in some instances, particularly in authoritarian countries, that might well be the case. But in other instances, I'm not sure whether, you know, one person's social network is another person's narrow interest group. So it's not clear to me that it's all that new.
Well, go ahead, Anne-Marie.
I think what the best counterexample is the election of Barack Obama, where the ability of many, many, many small donors to contribute easily and to organize made a major impact. It isn't just the availability of technology, it's that technology does allow millions of people to participate where once it was only the powerful.
Dan?
Well, if we're going to have to wait till 2012 to sort of see the long-term effects of this.
He was elected once.
What?
He was elected once, she says.
Right. There's certainly no question that it is a way to potentially leverage the influence of small amounts of people. But again, the question is whether sustaining that kind of enthusiasm over a significant amount of time is possible. These sorts of movements are very good at, you know, trying to create sort of focal points of attention where there is a particular issue or a particular concrete thing they want done. The question is that after it appears to be done, can they sustain that interest? And that's where I'm skeptical.
Well, and this is a very broad question, Dan, but do you think governments and even our own government is capable of dealing with all these intractable problems, whether they're domestic or international?
Well, in some ways, the answer is no, because those problems are persisting. So it suggests that these are really, really difficult problems. Otherwise, they wouldn't be at the top of the agenda. I think another question, and this sort of comes from something that Henry Farrell wrote that both Anne-Marie and I have responded to, is the question of whether or not governments can direct or respond to these networks effectively, or whether the very complexity that Anne-Marie talks about also means that, in fact, there are dangers in terms of trying to do a policy response that can lead to a catastrophic failure.
And who's Henry Farrell, Anne-Marie?
Henry Farrell is another professor. Danny's at George Washington?
Yeah, he's at the Elliott School there.
At the Elliott School, who wrote a very interesting post responding to us. He's talking about these larger issues of huge uncertain forces where very small events can have very big consequences, whether that's environmental or financial, and saying, look, it's like a world of contagion where somebody gets infected and then there's an epidemic and no one can respond. My argument is actually in that world of many different factors, we can be much more resilient. We can create conditions in which we're able to respond and adapt very quickly, precisely by connecting lots of different actors, all of whom have different abilities, and preparing them to be able to respond to whatever comes.
Anne-Marie, you have worked both in academia and in government. Are you saying that government is essentially having this, within, for instance, the State Department, they're having a similar conversation or even debate that you and Daniel Dresner have been having?
Exactly. Secretary Clinton has been very clear, and President Obama as well, that we live in an age where no one government can solve the problems we face, and indeed all the governments in the world working together can't solve these problems, that in fact we have to mobilize all the different actors in society. So again, you have to get corporations on board and non-governmental organizations and universities. You need broad coalitions to solve health problems, environmental problems, crime problems, non-proliferation, and that's how to do that and how to expand beyond governments talking to governments was very much and is very much part of Secretary Clinton's agenda.
Does that surprise you, Dan Dresner?
No, it doesn't. I mean, obviously, if governments can direct social networks or use them as a way of leveraging their own power, you would expect them to do so. The problem, again, comes to this question of trust. Networks don't work terribly well unless there's a fairly deep amount of trust among the nodes of a network. And there's going to be natural hostility and suspicion, first on policy issues like, let's say, climate change that have pretty significant distributional outcomes across the world. And second, there's also just generally a general distrust of the state probably trying to take a role in terms of directing these networks. Even the most open state, you know, like the United States, obviously promotes a fair amount of suspicion elsewhere. So the interesting question is, how does the government try to do these things without running into these problems of both distrust and disagreement?
Let me see what Cyril from Perkasie has to say. And Cyril, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks. I just had two quick points.
Sure.
One is, before the Arab Spring, the Zapatistas and Chiapas were actually the first to use the Internet and digital communities to create international solidarity and a kind of global response and oversight to the Mexican state's response to them. And then, I guess, second, I would just be wary of the U.S. government and State Department using social networks to advance U.S. interests and to create relationships with social movements, because U.S. interests are often diametrically opposed to the social movement's interests. And this is a perfect illustration of how the state adapts and kind of co-opts these technologies for their own narrow uses.
Well, let me give Anne-Marie Slaughter a chance to respond to that. Do you agree with Cyril, Anne-Marie?
Well, Cyril, thanks both for the example of Chiapas and the question. I do agree that government cannot direct networks or harness them. They won't do that. But let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. The State Department and the Environmental Protection Agency helped create the Global Cook Stoves Coalition. Now, how women cook with cook stoves around the world is a matter of carbon emissions. It's a matter of health in terms of breathing in smoke inside, and it's a matter of women's security who have to get firewood. So if you can improve the cook stoves that they cook with, you can reduce carbon emissions, increase the health of women and their families, and improve security. The government helped bring together other governments, foundations, and corporations for a whole different set of projects that would leverage the work that many groups are already doing. It didn't try to direct it. It just brought it together, because by bringing it together, that movement has much more power and impact.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Daniel Dressner?
I think the Cook Stoves Initiative is certainly laudable, but it's, again, the sort of classic case of an issue in which it is thought of as win-win-win. And, you know, for those issues, then, of course, this sort of method of organizing might be terribly effective. The question then becomes how much of world politics is win-win-win.
Mm. But I hear from Cyril's question is that he's, in a sense, maybe suspicious is too strong a word, but he's worried about governments co-opting social media and using it for their own ends. Is that something, Dan, that Cyril and others should worry about?
Well, it depends on whether or not they agree with the points of the U.S. government, but it is what governments do. Governments will co-opt, and you know, furthermore, not just governments, but also, you know, large, powerful private actors will co-opt any sort of, you know, new technology and try to advance the interests that they, you know, obviously prefer. This is how politics works, I would add. It's hardly unique to governments. Everyone wants to try to get these kinds of networks to agree with what they want to do. But governments, because they often have greater resources, are more adroit or more able potentially to try to do this. But I do think the sort of concern about co-optation by the state will often tend to fracture these kinds of networks between groups that feel like they can do business with the U.S. government and those that are just simply profoundly suspicious of it.
Emory, I'm wondering what your response is to WikiLeaks.
WikiLeaks is complicated. It's not complicated in its most essential form, which is that a member of the military illegally downloaded hundreds of thousands of cables that were intended to be confidential. They were intended to be confidential in the same way if a priest talks to a penitent or a lawyer talks to a client or a doctor talks to a patient. Those are all intended to be confidential, and they're necessary for those people to do their jobs. So the download of that information was criminal. The broadcast of it endangered many people who assumed, as human rights activists or political dissidents, that their conversations with United States government officials were confidential. More broadly, there is some information that was disseminated that probably has had some positive effects. Mm. But initially, in this case, it's not about a whistleblower leaking bad behavior. It's about somebody stealing privileged information and making it public for their own ends.
What do you think, Daniel Dressner?
I think WikiLeaks is a very interesting case. First of all, it shows the dangers potentially of governments trying to adapt a more networked form of organization. The reason that Bradley Manning was able to access all of these cables was in the wake of 9/11, the U.S. government decided that there had not been enough information sharing among all the intelligence and security agencies. So as a result, they sort of democratized the way in which one could access this kind of information, which was how Manning got it in the first place. I also think the way WikiLeaks has played out is a sort of classic example of, on the one hand, the ability of a network like WikiLeaks to actually, you know, try to change the conversation a little bit, but also the limits of trying to change the conversation towards its own stated purposes, which is, if you take a look at what Julian Assange intended through the release of the WikiLeaks cables, I think he thought of it as potentially an indictment of the U.S. government and a sort of highlighting the various evils that the U.S. had intended. And the interesting thing is what the actual effects were, which was the real problem WikiLeaks caused was not so much for the United States government, because it turned out that most of these cables demonstrated that what the U.S. says publicly is also what it says privately, but rather authoritarian governments that do business with the United States. And indeed, you know, you could argue that one of the things that at least triggered the uprising in Tunisia was, in fact, a WikiLeaks cable demonstrating the candid U.S. assessment of the corruption in the authoritarian government in Tunisia. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing is the way in which WikiLeaks has sort of, you know, dealt with this going forward, which is the organization is much, much weaker now than it was 6 months ago, which again suggests that although these things can create sort of splashy headlines, it's whether they can sustain this kind of activity over time that's the really interesting question.
And we only have a couple more minutes before we have to say goodbye, but to Anne-Marie Slaughter, has Daniel Dresner changed your mind in any way?
I think Dan, in his last comment, just made my point better than I ever could, that one person or a couple of people connected through WikiLeaks were able to release information that, by his account, contributed to the beginning of the Arab Spring, which has toppled governments, is changing the entire nature of a region, is putting pressure on Israel, and is affecting global security in a whole host of ways. I think that's my point. That individual actors can have that impact.
Well, Daniel Dresner, did Anne-Marie Slaughter change your mind in any way?
I think Anne-Marie has convinced me that in some ways part of our difference is the time horizon with which we're looking at things. I tend to think that Anne-Marie has a fair point that sort of in the day-to-day activities you can have a social network, you know, change the headline in a way that states would not necessarily have anticipated. Where I'm much more skeptical is over time the effect that these networks can have and the adaptability of states to these networks, such that even if they think they might be changing the agenda, it turned out they might just change the agenda for a very brief time, and the state response is winds up leading more of the status quo.
And Anne-Marie, do you imagine our great-great-grandchildren 100 years from now having the same conversation that we've been having or something else?
Well, I do think that our great-great-grandchildren will still live in a world of states, but I think it will be a world of states in which individuals are able to hold those governments much more accountable and are much more able to participate directly in politics to achieve good, but unfortunately also bad ends.
And Dan Dresner, do you imagine a world just ruled by zombies?
Well, you know, as I discussed in Theories of International Politics and Zombies,
I know,
Party,
exactly.
I have, you know, there are multiple different ways in which these zombie-infested worlds could break out. But something I'm clearly going to have to do more research for is the ways in which zombies can exploit social networking.
Well, on that note, we could go on, but we have to end our conversation. And Daniel Dresner, Anne-Marie Slaughter, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times, giving us a flavor for this argument that you've been having over the last couple of months.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Daniel Dresner, professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's a senior editor at the National Interest, a contributing editor of Foreign Policy, where he has a daily blog. And he was a guest on Radio Times earlier this year on a book that he wrote called Theories of International Politics and Zombies, hence the zombie question. Anne-Marie Slaughter is the Bert G. Kerstetter University Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University. She's a columnist for The Atlantic, and for 2 years at the very beginning of the Obama administration, she was director of policy planning for the State Department. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can check us out online. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.